Welcome to Poetry Lectures, featuring talks by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, Burmese poet Zayar Lin and English poet and translator James Byrne speak with the director of the Harriet Monroe Poetry Institute, Ilya Kaminsky. Zayar Lin is a poet, critic, translator, and teacher who lives in Rangoon, Burma, now officially known as Myanmar. He was born in 1959 and is one of the most influential living poets in Burma. He is also active as a translator, bringing the work of many modern poets to Burma for the first time. Poet James Byrne was born in England in 1977. He is editor of The Wolf magazine and is co-editor and translator of Bones Will Crow, the first collection of contemporary Burmese poetry available in the West. Poetry in Burma is a thousand-year-old tradition that has recently undergone rapid and extreme changes, often due to the shifting political climate. In the 1950s, the Marxist government promoted poetry for the people. When the military took control in 1962, the government clamped down on all aspects of life. For the next 50 years, all literature was subject to censorship. Even the use of common words and phrases was forbidden. Now, with the relaxation of censorship and access to the internet, Burmese poets are experimenting with a broad range of new styles. This conversation took place at the Poetry Foundation in Chicago in May 2013. Zayar Lin gives a quick overview of poetry in Burma, followed by James Byrne describing some of his considerations in selecting the poems for the anthology Bones Will Crow.
We have a long history of poetry in our culture, going back to 1146 or the 12th century during the first Burmese kingdom. Then in the 20th century, there were profound changes, especially in the 1930s and the 30s, when two great poets from Myanmar started this literary movement called Kissan, or Testing the Times, or Experimenting. They broke away with those centuries of classical poetry, and they came up with a very simple form. It's called a four-syllable rhymed form. And that is still considered the traditional poetic form in our country. And it is also the form of poetry, Burmese poetry, that is considered real Burmese poetry by the government. Then in the 50s, there was a new movement called Sabithi, or new writing or new literature. The difference between the earlier movement and the second movement was that in the second movement, poetry became very politicized. It was a leftist Marxist view of poetry. And these new slogans appeared like poetry for the people, poetry for the masses, art for people's sake. And that movement went on till the 80s, when the third important movement arose, which is the modernist poetry, Kipo Gabya, or modern poetry. And that third movement is still the mainstream now. And I suppose we are now witnessing a new movement, which I would call it the contemporary movement, which includes all the different types of different forms of poetry, including language-oriented poetry, conceptual poetry, digital poetry, fluff poetry, hybrid poetry. So today, we are seeing a diversity of poetic forms emerging, which had never been seen in the whole of last century. So I belong to that, the latest contemporary movement. And I have also been influential in leading this new contemporary movement.
Zayar Lin was just talking about the movement towards contemporary poetics and the diversity within that. Now, in editing Bones Will Crow, we had a very difficult decision initially, just thinking about trying to unravel the strands between whether we chose to include poets who wrote in Kitsan or Kitpor. Kitpor is modern poetry. Or to embrace and try and cover as wide a canvas as possible in including poets who write in these strands from language poetry to flaff, or whether to, you know, how far do we go back? So we left out major Burmese poets from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, including the likes of Dagon Thea, who is considered to be, he's a living legend, really. I think he's almost 100 years old now. And we left out Minthu Win, who is another legendary Burmese poet. So our focus was predominantly on poets who were born after the Second World War. And the anthology, in fact, ends with poets, well, younger than myself. For example, the final poet in the book was born in 1981 and is Meng Yu Pai. And he exemplifies, I believe, what Zhe Lin is talking about with regard to the diversity of poetic styles which currently exist in Burma today. It's a luxurious position to be in as an editor to look at Burmese poetry because it has always been the most important form of literature in the country and always been the most censored form of literature in the country. So again, there were various challenges in looking at poetry of pre-censorship and different arenas of censorship as well in the history of a country that essentially had been silenced from the rest of the world for 50 years.
I want to follow up a little bit on this question of censorship because in the West, say, in Eastern Europe, Czeslaw Milosz wrote a famous book called The Witness of Poetry. And in North America, contemporary poet Carolyn Forsher edited an influential anthology called Poetry of Witness. So I want to follow up on this question of censorship and poet's role as a witness. What is in Burma, in your opinion, the poet's role as a witness, and how does it enter your own work?
Before this lessening up of censorship, there weren't any poetry of witness per se, because the censorship was so severe that poets could not write anything about what's going on in the country at that time. So what poets had to do, especially during the Kipo or the modern period, was they had to internalize what they wanted to say, and write in the form of a lyric, eye-based, using imagery, then writing in a linear form, and ending in that epiphonic line. So I would say almost all of the Kipo poems were in that vein, very expressive. So what they were expressing was their own feelings, and those feelings were understood to represent the feelings of the people. So there weren't any direct representation of what was happening in the country or what the government was doing in the poems. So instead of saying that the country, at one time it was considered least developed country, we were not able to talk about poverty. So what poets did was they talked about how poor they were, about their family, how they could not afford to buy rice or shoes or things like that. So in that way, there wasn't that kind of poetry of witness that Czesław Miłosz said, or even the kind of poetry that other people wrote in East Europe. But now, after this abolishment of censorship, we are finding this emergence of what you call this poetry of witness, because poets are now writing directly about things happening in the country, the economic failures, the way the ex-military government sold huge plots of land containing natural resources to China. And the latest subject that is being written by a lot of poets is the sectarian violence. So we are seeing this poetry of witness only after abolishment of this censorship.
Very interesting. James, would you like to follow up on that at all?
Well, I'd just like to make the point, I suppose, to echo what Zhe Lin is saying here. It's really the beginnings of post-censorship literature in Burma. We're only talking about a decision that was made some 9 months ago. So it'd be interesting to see how direct the poetry might become. What are the consequences of this? For example, in editing Bones Will Crow, the poets of Zhe Lin's generation and the younger generation had to be so inventive to avoid censorship. And that inventiveness is something which I've consistently admired about the poetics. You know, this is a country where you couldn't use the word red in a poem. When General Ne Win was in power, you couldn't talk about the setting of the sun in a poem because his name related to the sunset. So, yeah, I think now that with these, essentially we're talking about less fear and more freedom, and what the consequences of that might be for the poetry of Burma.
Well, I want to stop for a moment to focus a little more on the language of poetry itself. How has the language changed when a poet tried to confront censorship. You speak about inventiveness. Could you give us more examples on a page, like maybe with a poem?
Yes. One way try to go past the censorship was to use images. And then another way was to avoid using words like red or poverty or suffering. And instead of that, some of us use irony, writing in a way as if we were living in a very rich land and we were filthy rich and enjoying ourselves. Mm-hmm. One way I use in my poetry, which I'm going to read out soon, is making the persona dead. So it's like a dead man speaking. So that was in 2005. When the censorship read this, they passed it because, you know, I think they felt that, you know, the words of a dead man don't have any weight or any bearing. So luckily that poem passed the censorship. So I'd like to read that in Burmese first. Ngatamai ha, ngatamai mhopu. Ngate biluda, dago nga makwe mahwep yo yere. Ngatamai ngu yigera, nga mhopu. Lu se yao ma, sete yao, ngago matibu. Turu yigere ngatamai ngu, turu matibu. Amatea yong sazia, ngama bahama mshibu. Champu zuzia, matantinzia, turu yigeja maba. Tabime, ngama mamibu. Chow sarai mshibu, ogu mshibu, ayo mshibu, piata mshibu. Ngatamai ngu nga yigera mhopu. Turu yigera, turu pinya shindwe. Turu yigera, turu amantea dwe. Turu yigera, shwe mhongche danda idwe. Eri te ma nga bena sa pa ketale. Nga te dwe nga mati gebu. Nga te jengu turube yegere. Te jeng a chinjin jama. Nga ha amima polo du te jeng lu. Dokita te jeng lu. Te jeng da masi manke yabu. Te jeng ma le nga ha nene kaya biande. Nga ma piazia sa yue sa dan a tau ta dwe. Turu pibi song song ma yege ja biambu. Te jeng ma nga ne tai ngwe mshi biambu. Nga te jengu, turu be ye jare. Nga te jengu, turu lede ye jare. Ye jare, ye jare, ye de ye jare. Nga bian payare, daha nga tamang be. Zagalong bong ma, dada lue cho. Ta bong dong, belu tan toyam lemati. Nga tamangu, turu ye be. Nga go, tamang de got to like de. Akuma be, nga tamang a sado de. Akuma be, nga tamang a jirome. And this poem has been translated by Coco Tet and James Byrne, and the title in English is My History Is Not Mine. I am already dead. I can say this unreservedly. It wasn't me who wrote my history. 11 out of 10 people don't know me. Historians have no idea about my history written by historians. I have no souvenir whatsoever for sale. PhD scholars, journalists, they might have written my history, but I don't remember it. No stone inscription, no tomb, no bone, not even ash. I have not written my history. They have written it for me, those academics. They have written their own versions. What they have written were mythologies sprinkled with gold dust. How many sprinkles did I amount to in there? I wasn't aware of the death pit. They have written even my own death amid debts and deader debts. I was almost death untitled, a crippled death. Even the debt wasn't genuine. Even in death I was exiled. They did not fully write my supporting documents. Even in death I did not have a residence permit. They have written my death. They have written my death in air. They have written my death in water. I read it again, my own history. Misspellings, missed grammar. I don't even know how to pronounce the word vocabulary. They have written my history. Then they have airbrushed me from history. My history has just begun. I'm going to write my own history.
Thank you very much. James, having spent so much time with poetry from a very different culture and language, and I wonder how this relationship to very different linguistic culture affected your own work?
Well, if we think of Zeilin's poem, My History Is Not Mine, it's the importance of this word would equate with the soul or love. It's such an important word to use in a poem. So it's taken myself some time to get used to linguistically just thinking about how words are, they gain or lose significance through translation. Going back to my sort of apprenticeship as a poet, if you like, it's been only really made possible through an interest in translation. And what I mean by that, for example, if we think of about a poem concerning New York City, I'm very interested in terms of my own skullscape, how someone like John Ashbery would write about New York City compared with someone like Adonis from Syria. So these kind of decisions, and I suppose they are active decisions, and I believe poetry is a form of activism, and translation is a form of activism, not necessarily from the sense of waving one's fist in the air or starting rallies, but I think poetry is active for me. It's always been an active process. And translation, there's a nice phrase of Burmese poet Kin Aung A, who says that translation for him was like climbing the top of a tree to get at the fruit. And I think that I myself, as a poet living in England, it's hard to find those trees. I'm lucky I rely on finding poetics from various countries around the world. Examples of that are really through contributing in festivals. For example, I was sent to Syria in 2009 by the British Council. It widened my reading exponentially. I was sent to Libya around this time last year. Again, I suddenly had a new direction for my thinking as a poet, as a human being. And of course, I've been to Burma now and been researching the literature for the last 6 years this book took to make. So these kind of things help feed the addiction of being a poet, I suppose, for which there is no cure, so one must become more and more addicted.
Well, poetry has always been a part of social activism, political activism in our country. Starting from the very beginning of the 20th century, we had this poet called the King Cold of Mine, who was very political in his poems, very political. And later, during the first movement of Cassin, that political substance was, you know, it was lost in a way. Because at that time, the Cassin poets were studying under, they were studying in Yangon University, which was still under the British colony at that time. And especially since these two famous poets, Mintu and Xia Zhouji, they were educated in Cambridge University. So, you know, they came back with, not with pro-British colonial attitude, but it was the nationalistic attitude was a bit watered down. So during the second movement, during this new writing movement started by the Gong Daya, what the Gong Daya did was he brought in this ideology, this Marxist ideology, into Myanmar poetry world. So what the King Cold of Mine was doing was more nationalistic poetry, you know, sometimes harking back to the old Burmese kings, kingdoms. But what the Gong Daya did was to imbue poetry with an ideology. So up to now, any self-respecting Burmese poet would say that poetry is activism.
What happens after censorship is lessened? What happens to the language of the tradition?
In terms of language, we are seeing new words coming into the language, especially words that are related to technology. So in one sense, contemporary poems contain these words that come from technology, which were never used in the previous times, well, naturally, because they didn't have the technology. So in these current poems, you can find words like Google, mouse, website, Facebook, DNA, and things like that. So in that way, our newer poetry, this contemporary poetry, will show the kind of new usages that were never found in the earlier times, not even 20 years ago. So in that sense, the language used in poetry has changed. And another way is that of the use of found language. Now, a lot of poets are using language from newspapers, language from advertisements, language from magazines, news reports, even from poetic texts. So at one time, these were considered unpoetic. Now, the younger poets have the freedom to make use of any found language in their poems and create a new texture. In my own work, I have also used found language. And at one time, I used the headings of news reports in a newspaper. And I collaged them into a poem. And I called it Nga Mya Zwane, Tadin Sa Tha Mya. Many, many eyes and newspaperies or journalists. And one very famous poet, Kipo poet, Aung Cheng, whom I respect very much, he asked me if that was poetry. And I said, why not? And he said, how can you create poetry with language from newspapers? And I said, why can't I create poetry from language or newspapers or from other registers? So that was in about 10 years' time. But now, the younger generation has followed my lead, and they know that there is no such thing as poetic language. No part of language can be restricted. Any part of language, any discourse, any register can be used to make poems, poetry.
I just wanted to ask, does that create a kind of turbulence? Because there's some, obviously many poets would want a more traditional approach than that. And the other thing I suppose I was just going to ask you, say that we're also talking here about online poetry as well as a process. There are many poets in Bones Will Crow that we simply would not have found under the censorship laws of a few years ago, which was when we were doing the research, unless we looked at their blogs, unless we looked at how they were trying to create a new kind of poetics through publishing online.
Before we go to online poetry, I'd like to give some examples of what I was saying just now of using found language. This comes from my poem, Slideshow, which is included in Bones the Crow. This poem is made of fragments, and I'll read out some of the fragments that were considered unpoetic, which should not be used in poetry. For example, Maria Xiao, Channel News Asia, Beijing. That is not, in the past, people would say that is not poetic. It's not an image or anything. It's just a line taken from an anchor woman from Channel News Asia. But I deliberately took it and I used it in this poem to show that there is something bigger than us. There's a world out there. And anchor men, anchor women in the world are giving news and giving their names in it. So that's one thing. Another example is loathing plus fear plus fear and loathing. Now, this medical symbol of addition, this plus, had never been used in Burmese poetry before. So bringing in minus, plus, equal, these things have changed this surface of the Burmese poetry now. And another one is bringing in lyrics into poems. For example, this song, Yellow Submarine, by the Beatles. So I got two lines there. We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine, yellow submarine. Next slide. So the surface form or the texture of Burmese contemporary poems have become, in one way, they've become very fragmented. And the use of this found language, the use of ordinary language, the use of language that was considered unpoetic in the past have now all come into poems. And, you know, being juxtaposed with poetic lines, non-poetic lines, words from advertisements, things like that.
This makes me think of Nicanor Parra, a great poet of Chile who wrote during the Pinochet regime, and he called his poetry anti-poetry. So there are these similarities in different parts of the world, in different poetics, yeah?
You have the same phrase bandied around in Burma. There's the idea of an anti-poetry as well. I think it's, I won't name names, but it's always interesting, isn't it, this idea of recovery, trying to recover a national literature at times of great change.
Yes, talking about anti-poetry in Burma, sorry, in Myanmar, anti-poetry can be considered outlaw poetry by those mainstream poets who are acknowledged poets, respected poets in their way. And so when these new forms of poems appeared, they would dismiss them as not poetry, anti-poetry, against poetry. But then those of us who deliberately wrote these new forms, we enjoyed being called anti-poetry, which means we were not them. So it was like a badge of honor for us because we were doing something alternative to mainstream.
Very interesting. James, in your opinion, where is this transition headed?
Well, I'm still learning the possibilities, the permutations of attempting to answer this question. But one possibility is that there's a group of poets called the post-88 generation. Of course, 88 was a horrific year in the history of Burma. And the post-88 generation are doing ostensibly what Zaylin is talking about, making use of a lot of found language, found information. The poetry is much more direct in some senses. It makes use of anaphora more and more. The interesting thing I'd say about it, in perhaps contrast to that, is that the post-88 generation, and here I'm thinking of some very fine poets, actually, for example, Han Lin, who's in his early 20s, they are not so concerned with reading the great old masters. So post-88 is the defining line, and they're ostensibly going to read one another. And I do think there is an inherent danger in that. You know, it's all fine and well for me to say this as a really someone who is essentially a tourist of Burmese literature, but I do think whichever country you're in, not reading the great masters is problematic.
Yes, you're right. One strand of this post-88 generation is what we call documentary writing, when poets are writing about things happening in the country in a very direct way, almost like in a journalistic way, except that it's in a form of written in lines. So if you consider lines as the basic unit of poetry, we can call it poetry. But then if you instead of bringing it down into lines, if we write it in prose form, it becomes prose again. So in a way, when we're talking about form, I think it's a loss because it becomes more prosaic and losing the poetic qualities. But that's one strand that's happening now. Another strand is parodying the older canonical texts and, you know, using intertextual strategies. That belongs to this group of poets who call themselves Pem School. They are very much under the influence of Laugh, of Gary Snyder, Nada Gordon, Sharon Mesmer, and people like that. So what they do is they parody the famous poems of the past. Now, for example, Aung Ching wrote this classical modern poem called Gandawin Mama, which means classical lady. So what these Pem School poets did was they came up with a book called Lala Ji. In Burmese, Lala Ji means big and beautiful lady, which sort of alludes to Aung Ching's classical lady. But then in the poems of these Pem School poets, you know, you find a lot of lines in earlier canonical poems, playing about with those lines or juxtaposing those great lines with some stupid, funny lines. So that's one thing. Another strand, the latest strand that I noticed about 3-4 months ago, is the ludic, the playful strand. You know, these young poets who are of the same age as the Pem School poets, they came out with a book called To Lan Chao. In English, it means revolutionary cats. On the cover of the book, which was in red, was this picture of a cat which looked very similar like Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao Zedong of China. So instead of Chairman Mao, there was this picture of a cat, and they named it Chairman Miao. And they called themselves the Miaoists. So, and in the book, too, the poems are very playful, you know, playing with language, which a lot of older poets did not like at all, because they feel that these Maoists are destroying poetry, the seriousness of poetry. They are degrading the value of poetry. So that's what we are seeing now. One strand of this, I would call them post-ADA generation or contemporary poetry, that ludic aspect, and I like it too.
There's just one thing I'd add as a caveat to that, is that at the same time, you have many fine poets of Zaya Lynn's generation and others who are also still very interested in recovering or reclaiming or re-emphasizing, if you like, Burmese poems that have now become out of print. So, for example, I have to mention it today as we're at the Poetry Foundation, but you have the Burmese Poetry Foundation, who were inspired by the Poetry Foundation, surprise, surprise. And they it's run ostensibly by Kin Ong A, and he really makes sure that he is republishing texts which people have no access to anymore. So I think that it's fascinating that you have this binary process happening simultaneously.
We are trying to bring these younger poets to tradition of Myanmar poetry, especially modern poetry. But a lot of these younger poets feel that they don't have to look back to the past, that they can just move on. I think at one stage, they will realize that, you know, when their battery goes down, they will realize that they will have to go back to the past and to go back to their roots and find out where they came from. See, so right now what has happened is with the translations of language poetry, New York school of poetry, post-Soviet poetry, FLAF, they have seen that translations of these different kinds of poetry have done away with the kind of poetry in the past, and they have the license to move on, to go any direction they want. But then I feel that one day they will have to look back and see where they came from. If not, there will be a dead end.
Do you mind if I just read a short poem, which gives you an idea? It's the final poem in Bones Will Crow. Gives you a sense of a poet who does look back to the past and is perhaps, I'm speculating, but perhaps doing this in order to continue to be modern. This is a poem by Meng Yu Pai, born in 1981. Under the Great Ice Sheet. Under the great ice sheet, a great country has been buried alive. Under the great country, a great church where God no longer shelters. Under the great church, great wars welded together 6 feet under. Under the great wars, a great museum of culture, dilapidated and yellowing. Under the great museum, banknotes without currency. Under the banknotes, slaves with protruding bones and sunken eyes. Under the slavery, a Stone Age cave sealed by stones. Under the Stone Age, regressive evolution. Under the evolution, the ocean, the mother of Mother Earth, who died in labor. Under the ocean, a great ice sheet, unanticipated. Under the great ice sheet, .. Meng Yu Pai is now writing poems very different to this, going back to issues of post-censorship. But this is a very pivotal marking point, I believe, in his own writing and also the history of modern Burmese poetry.
Yes. Throughout the past 50 years or so, what we have seen in Myanmar poetry is pushing boundaries and opening up the world of poetry to new dimensions. And that was what the new literature movement did, the Sabit did. Then that was again what Kipo, or modern poetry, did. It pushed the boundaries of poetry into new areas, into new fields. It's the same thing is happening now in this contemporary poetry. Poets, including myself and others, we are not happy to stay within the confines of this Kipo or modern poetry anymore. We want to push the boundaries open up poetry into postmodern or contemporary world. And what we poets have always done was to search for new ways of writing poetry. to search and to discover and to make our own poems based on our discoveries. And that was how translation has become a very important issue. Because if we look at the models of Kipor poetry, what we were doing at that time was we were just reproducing the same models again and again and again. And we were quite fed up with that. But at the same time, we didn't know where and how to find new models because we had no access to the world at that time during the late 80s, early 90s, no internet, no books, no resources. But luckily, whatever we could find were spread among fellow poets. And I did a lot of translating. And through those translations, poets began to see that Kipor poetry is not the be-all and end-all of poetry, that there's this whole new world of poetry out there. And so some of the poets, sensing this newness, came to borrow or came to make use of these new formal ways of making poetry. And these new formal ways, of course, came a lot from New York School, from Ashbery, especially the indeterminacy in his poems. That was something that a lot of poets liked very much. And from language poetry, they learned about these disjunctive strategies, about parataxis, about fragments of found language being collage. And another one was this, what I call this list or catalog poem, in which, you know, you have a list of lines that are not related to any other line, but each line containing one word that is repeated again in every line. And I've used that technique or that list form or catalog form in one of the poems here in Bones and the Crow. May I read that? I'll read that in Burmese verse. It's called Mokse to I Toaya Lamya. And the only cohesive device in all of these lines is the word Mokse. Mokse to I Toaya Lamya. Mark siya mose tema gaba kaya memia silonja the chong bari. Sadka mose matada ha piti mu badana awada asade. Binle binle sitemo the town silo lighta helen ye mose la. Gabia go shani de sagalong duigo, mezi go shani de mose. So it goes on with the word mostly repeated in every line. Now, in English, it would be the ways of the beards. There is a hair, the rhymeless of the world unite in Marx's beard. Not growing a beard is existentialism, says Sartre. Helen's beard that has launched 1,000 ships. Beards looking for a chin like words for a poem. And so there is no narrative in this poem, there's no lyric, love story, anything, just lines containing this word mostly a beard. And the last line to contains that word mostly a beard, but the last line doesn't necessarily mean the last line in the poem. In fact, it can go on.
Can I just recommend as co-editor that it's a fantastic poem and our listeners have to just hunt down the book. I'm sorry you didn't get the chance to read it all. I just wanted to mention one thing, just quickly, if I could ask Zaylin, and you also, Ilya, as a poet. The influence of repetition seems to be, it's not just, of course, something that is new to us. It comes from the ancient religious texts. It's been in poetry throughout the ages. Is this abundance of anaphora, repetition, somehow too much of a game playing, or does it relate more to aspects of really sort of primal urges, things like chanting? What do you think?
Well, I think it can refer to both because in the hands of mediocre poets, it's like a gimmick, you know, to try to make a lot of nonsense cohere by repeating the same pattern, I would say. I think it's called parallelism. But in the hands of great poets, that it's called nabe in Burmese, repetition of not necessarily the same line, but the repetition of that structure gives that poem a very sonic value. It gives it that rhythm that is very nice to hear and also adding to the meaning of the poem.
James, would you mind perhaps finishing and reading one more poem from the anthology just to give the listeners a little more of a scope of the book and what you think Burmese poetry can teach you as audience?
Right, so something that also talks back to anaphora as well. I'd like to read a poem by Aindra. And before I read it, I'll just say one thing because we haven't touched on this. Women have generally been treated as second-class citizens in a country like Burma for a long time, and it still continues. And educational reform, I think, is really needed in the country. And also just attitudes towards women. So I think Aindra is speaking back to this by using persona and inventing a character called Lily. Lily flutters her dark wavy eyelashes from her long ivy hair, from her cheeks, from her neck. A bunch of rainbows bloom in the middle of the night. Her thin top, curvy and bent, her mini jeans torn and tight. Lily serves beer. Lily cringes more than necessary. Lily comes close more than necessary. Lily mixes herself appositely. Lily has her own recipe, cultures her own yeast. Lily cooks the pose of a she-cat in a pencil heel for an appetizer. Lily walks the glass bead strings on her pearly breasts into munchies. Lily's black irises are like a virgin crow stalking its prey. Lily moves like meatloaf about to be snatched by a hawk. Lily serves beer. Lily promotes beer with her scent. Lily promotes her scent with beer. Lily serves beer. Amid the buzzings of rowdy blowflies, lusty looks fume as Lily uncorks the syrupy sweet laughter. Pop! Lily pours her froth of giggles to be forked at, gummed and swallowed. With cloudberry lips, Lily serves. Lily's nonchalant smile pierces their stares. Lily serves. Lily knifes words with her gabble. Lily serves. Lily wants to flow in their arteries. Lily serves. Lily serves like a shaggy she-terrier cajoling. Lily smashes herself to fit into a bottle for her masters. Lily serves. Lily, her face uninterested at the news of homecomings, transplants her life branch to branch to serve another beer. Lily the bait. Lily the cheery fisherwoman who chaffs. Life is bitter. Life is beer. Lily serves another beer. I am God's glitch, she serves. I am a tiny she-snake from the wicker basket of the snake charmer, she serves. Because it is not bedtime yet, another. Because on Lily the nights pour down, another. Dawn unbudded, where the darkness lingers, where the day is yet to shed new light. Lily serves beer. Lily has just served. Lily is serving.
That was James Byrne reading a poem titled Lily by Aindra, which appears in the anthology Bones Will Crow. Byrne and Zayar Lin were speaking with Ilya Kaminsky. This program was recorded at the Poetry Foundation in Chicago on May 8, 2013, as part of International Poets in Conversation, and was sponsored by the Harriet Monroe Poetry Institute. Zayar Lin's poetry collections include Distinguishing Features, Real-Life Prose Poems, and Kilimanjaro. He has also translated into Burmese numerous American and European poets. James Byrne is co-editor and translator of Bones Will Crow, 15 Contemporary Burmese Poets, which includes poems by Zayar Lin. The anthology was published in 2012. Byrne's own poetry collections include Passage of Time and Blood Sugar. Keep up with the world of poetry by visiting poetryfoundation.org, where you'll find articles by and about poets, an online archive of more than 10,000 poems, the Harriet blog about poetry, the complete back issues of Poetry Magazine, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.